was talking with a friend this week about things supernatural, and she'd read recently a book by, I believe, a neurosurgeon about near-death experiences or being dead and then returning, being resuscitated. And she asked, she said, what do you think about those things? And so we discussed it a little, and she said, well, this person is all about Jesus. And I thought, well, that's really, we said, you know, that's really the bottom line. If your strange experience leads you to Christ, that's what really matters. We talked a little bit about people who have dreams. I have a friend in the Middle East. He's a missionary. And I've been told that there was a guy who had a dream that said, you need to go read this book with this man. And the man was a missionary, and he read about Jesus. And that's how the man was led to trust in Christ. Well, these supernatural things happen. The bottom line with such things, as we discussed it, is that everything that matters when it comes to our salvation and supernatural things is about Jesus and whether or not we trust him. That salvation is only in him, through him. Like it says in John 14:6, no one comes to the Father but through him. But the journeys that bring us to him, to the person of Jesus, are not all the same. If we were to listen to some testimonies in this room about how God worked in our lives and the circumstances that brought us to trust in him, we would hear very different testimonies around the room. Well, our passage today sort of points us in these directions, towards the supernatural, towards a strange journey that some magi had. It's a familiar story. It's something that we're all quite familiar with. And I've heard people saying lately this week that what we want as Christians is we want to remember what Christmas is all about. So let's look at this account again, this narrative, which is Matthew chapter 2. If you could be open to that, that would be helpful. It begins with some magi and a star, it is called. And it's a very familiar story. We have, just in the previous verses, Joseph, Mary, and the baby. And they're settling in Bethlehem, where they went because of the census. But the story doesn't begin with them. It starts with these wise men, these magi, who are from the east. Now, we don't know how many there were. Often we speculated in songs. Because there are three gifts, they speculated that there were three of these. But we don't really know how many there were. And in the beginning verses, we see something interesting. Herod is mentioned, and he's called the king. Herod, this guy Herod, was the great king. He's called Herod the Great. Benjamin Netanyahu has called him Herod the Great Builder because of what he accomplished and the structures that still remain to this day. Herod, at this time, was at the peak of his power and his achievements. And he's called here in verses 1 and 3, he's called the king in Matthew's gospel. And I think that's on purpose, because in Matthew's gospel, we're seeing that from the very first verse, that this is the gospel about this person, Jesus, who's called the Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham, that he is a type of royalty, the promised Messiah. In verse 2, there's an awkward question from these magi where they say, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? This is one of those awkward questions where it's asked and then the person being asked doesn't even want to hear such a question. Herod himself saw himself as the king. And you can imagine the people around him sort of wincing, thinking, oh, why did they ask that? You don't go there. Well, the wise men also, it says in our passage that they were brought here by this supernatural event, this star. Or I've been persuaded that it probably was something like a comet, because of the way they act. And there's been lots of research, and there are different theories. It doesn't really matter. Something in the sky, planet, comet, something that led them here. Now, here's the thing. When these magi arrive, they go to Jerusalem. They go to Herod. They're close. They're in Judea, and they go to him. And they ask this awkward question. Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? And that question is sandwiched between where Matthew calls Herod, Herod the king. Okay? Now, few things, this is just a general rule, few things are more awkward than when you show up for the party and the host knows nothing about the party. Remember that this week. Herod has these people that show up. They come from far away. And they come with incredible gifts. And they come with an incredible question. And they show up at his front palace, I guess. And probably his servants welcome them. And they say, yeah, we'd like to talk to the king. We're from the east. We'd like to talk. Herod is shrewd. You can read about him. There's a lot that's written about him in Roman history. And he thought on his feet. And you can imagine what was happening here. He certainly would have offered the hospitality that these wise men might have expected. Herod loved to live in luxury. He loved to display his power. He loved to build things for his glory, things that remain to this day. Stones that are now today the Temple Mount, the big palace and the fortress that is called Masada. These are things that Herod, with aqueducts that brought water to this mountain palace. Herod, who was called Herod the Great, who did these things, was shrewd, and he thought on his feet this day that the Magi visited him. And while welcoming them, and while outwardly showing them hospitality and talking with them, his heart was not with their hearts. We see that in the text, and we could get that just by reading, if you read Josephus, the Roman historian, you can learn about this man, Herod the Great. He had no intention of worshiping a king who was to be king of the Jews. He wanted to preserve his own place as what he would call the king of the Jews. Now, verse 3 explains this to us. It says that Herod, that he was troubled, and it says that all Jerusalem was troubled with him. That's an interesting phrase. We need to get back to that. He brought the Torah scholars on this day. He brought the Torah scholars who are called the chief priests and the scribes. These are sort of the equivalent of the Magi who were there in Jerusalem among God's people. And Herod wanted to ask these where the Messiah was to be born. And very quickly they were able to answer him in Bethlehem, because it says in the prophet Micah, and they quote it. So he brought these wise men who are from the east, then perhaps the same day. I think it was all happening very quickly. It might have been later. It doesn't say a timeline, but I think it's probably later the same day. Brings the wise men back to him, and it says that he ascertained from them. He got them to say, when did this star arise? When did this happen? Like, when was he born? What do you know? Now, these are magi. These are men who would look to the stars to try to interpret things. They would do strange things. They might look at the entrails of an animal and say, this is telling us that these things are going to happen. So strange things. But Herod looks at them and he says, well, secretly, he tricks them and he says, when did the star rise? And he was trying to get an age for this little child. And his thought was, if I can figure out the age, I can kill the child and we can just be done with this little incident. These people can go on their way. He secretly ascertained from them the time. Now, the thing is here that Herod made a big mistake. What he does then, and I don't know why he does this when you read this. In the narrative, you see that Herod sends them on their way. And I don't know if Herod was overly confident that he saw that they trusted him, or he perceived that they trusted him, or that maybe he wasn't taking this king seriously enough. But he sends them on their way and he says, search diligently for this child, and when you found him, come back to me that I can worship him too. So he sends them. But he doesn't send anyone to watch them. He doesn't send people to sort of be his agents to keep track of where they're going or where they want to worship this little child. And it says that after listening in verse 9 to the king, they went on their way. And I wonder if it says that because maybe they suspected that maybe they smelled a little bit of a rat. It says after listening. It doesn't say after agreeing to what the king had requested of them. It just says that after listening, they went on their way. So when the Magi went, the star appeared and led them to Bethlehem, to the very house where the child was. Look at verse 9. It came to rest over the place where the child was. God pinpointed the very home where Christ was with Mary and with Joseph. And they found him and they worshiped him, presenting their gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. These were kingly gifts. These three things have never been inexpensive. These are gifts that are fit for a king. And much has been written about how there's sort of a parallel here where maybe these Magi knew something through the prophets, through the Torah, through about this Messiah, that he would be a prophet, a priest, and a king. But these were incredible gifts, and they give them to him. And next, we see in the narrative that God warns these wise men in a dream not to return to Herod. And so they take another road. They go back to their own country again. When they left Joseph and Mary, it seems like it happens very quickly. Perhaps these wise men set off on their journey, and then maybe that same night, it seems to me that it was very quick, it was very rapid. Joseph has another dream, and an angel appears to him, and he's told that Herod's going to try to search for and kill the child, so he has to go. So in the middle of the night, when the angel speaks to Joseph again, Joseph wakes up and he rises immediately. And while it's still night, by night, right away, they get out of town. And you get the picture as you read this narrative that they're basically leaving and going south towards Sinai while Herod's thugs are coming into Bethlehem. It was a little town. It was a rundown little town. Now, our narrative also tells us that Herod, feeling the insult to his glory, sends to kill these children who were 2 years old or younger. It says that Herod, seeing that he was tricked. Now, here, if you're a prideful person, it's easy to perceive that people are insulting you. It happens quickly. It happens often. God knew, though, the evil that this man would do long before it happened. Now, because he says the children 2 years old or younger, that doesn't mean that Jesus was 2 years old by this time, but probably that Herod, in his rage, wanted to do a sweeping execution, to do away with any child that might look or seem to be even older than the date that he actually was. So maybe he was one, maybe he was younger than one, maybe just a few months. We don't really know. I think that Herod's 2 years old or younger was a sweeping collection of children. And Sinclair Ferguson, in something that he wrote, said that based on the population of Bethlehem at that time, would have been about 20 children that were slaughtered. Would have been like a thing, and it was news that spread through the area of how wicked this man was. People were very upset. Herod had a habit of doing these kinds of things, and the people of Judah did not like it. There was great weeping. God predicted this. God knew that it would happen, what this wicked man would do, and he spoke it through the prophet Jeremiah, as we read here. Later, then, by my sort of trying to put together the timeline with Roman history and when this Herod died, it seemed like maybe a year later, maybe a little more, 13, 14 months later, by my count, an angel speaks to Joseph again in another dream, when he's in Egypt, and he says that those who sought the child's life are dead. He uses the plural, those. Now, we're just thinking about Herod. He's this maniac king that cares about himself, and he's paranoid about people that are around him that might threaten his kingship. Herod dies, but it says those. So maybe he's expressing this, Herod and his thugs. God says, those who sought the child's life are dead, to Joseph. And he says, take the child and his mother, go back to Israel. And Joseph obeys immediately. But he's also a man who uses his reason. He uses common sense. It says that Archelaus was ruling in Judah. He was in Jerusalem. Archelaus was just as violent and dangerous as his father. right after Herod the Great dies, his one son, and now Herod had killed many of his family members, people that were close to him. He was insane. If he thought anyone was a threat to his throne, they didn't live long. He had multiple wives. He had multiple sons and daughters. When this Archelaus, when his father dies, Archelaus speaks to the people with kindness. This was a very messed up family. Archelaus goes and he speaks to the people and he says, "Look, we're going to undo some of the wrongs that my father did. I know that you're upset. I know that he had a heavy hand." And he speaks to the people. Well, the people then, according to what Archelaus said, was he thought they were presumptuous and they were asking for way too much. And he said, "Okay, well, let me settle things with Caesar so that Caesar officially tells me that I'm the king in my father's place. And then when that's done, we'll settle these things. But let's hold your horses for now." What happened was that night, the people gathered mourners for some other people that Herod had slaughtered, had killed children. And the people gathered mourners that turned into a mob scene. What happened was Herod sent to stop these people with some guards. The guards get stoned by the mob. And then the mob goes on mourning like nothing had happened. That's the words that Josephus uses. Just Josephus. Herod then goes and sends an army, this Archelaus, and he kills what Josephus says was 3,000 people. Massive execution. He was just as violent. He was just as messed up as his father. Violent and dangerous. So it says that Joseph went to Galilee. Now, Galilee, it ended up being that the province of Judah was divided among three of Herod's sons. And the one that was there was named Philip. Philip was sort of the weakling. He was sort of the sneaky, weak brother. You remember it later in Matthew, it says that John the Baptist was in prison because Herod the Tetrarch, that would be Herod Antipas, he was the third of these three kings. Hard to keep all these Herods straight, isn't it? Okay, so picture this. In my mind, it went something like this. Herod Antipas, Herod the Tetrarch, he's having some family together for Yom Kippur, something like that. Okay, Philip shows up at the party, and his wife is beautiful, Herodias, okay? And that Herod, Antipas, Herod the Tetrarch, says to his weaker brother Philip, "Wow, she's beautiful. She's really beautiful. She's going to stay here with me. And you go home, Philip." And eventually, John the Baptist comes along and says, "You shouldn't do that. That's against God's law. You shouldn't have your brother Philip's wife." Remember that? Chapter 14. That's why Herod was held in prison. It's a messed up family. So that's how they end up in Nazareth, because of this family, because of these political dynamics. And they end up in Nazareth of Galilee. They would be more off the radar. It would be a safer place than closer to Jerusalem. And it says at the end of our narrative that Jesus would be called a Nazarene. So like I said, this is a very familiar story to us. We've heard it read. We've read it ourselves many, many times. I wonder if we could go back to this time when these things were happening, and if we could ask the people in this narrative some questions. If you could ask them any question, what would you ask them? I have a few. I'd like for us to imagine how they would answer if we could interview these people. My first question is for Herod. He is fascinating. He's this arch villain. He worked for decades to make a name for himself that would last. He wanted to be known as the great king of Israel. He built, you know what he did? He took the temple area. He removed all this massive land, this top of this mountain, so that he could level it and then he could build a temple mount that is still there to this day. The smallest stones in this structure for the temple mount weigh more than 2 tons. The smallest. It is an incredible structure. The one wall where you see the Jewish people praying and putting little things in the wall, that is part of this temple mount. That's the western wall or the wailing wall. Herod, we still talk about him. When we took our tour in Israel last month, Herod's name is all over the place. People talk about Herod the Great and all the things that he did. When you're at Masada, when you look at the lavish things that he did and built, it's incredible because his desire was to make his name glorious, that it would last and last. And two millennia later, here we are, still talking about this guy. You might say that it worked, that he wanted to preserve his name, and in a way, in this world, he has. When Jesus is born, Herod's glory is rudely interrupted by some magi that show up from the east for a party that Herod wasn't planning on throwing. At this point, Herod was at the height of his glory. He had built these great things. And this announcement of a king being born was an incredible threat. So if we were to interview him, and this was in the last few years of his life, if we were to interview him, I would ask this question. And I would ask it in a way that I would probably be through a video link, because he was so dangerous. But this is how we would ask it. We would say, Herod, you like that? Have a picture of the village of Eagle behind me. And say, Herod, would you please tell us, who is the great king of Israel? I wonder how he would answer that. I think he would answer this way. I think he would say, I am Herod, the great king. And I think he would say it in such a way that we would wonder if it might be the last question we ever asked. And I think that Herod would take off his microphone and walk away at that point. It would be a short interview. And so I would turn next to the people of Jerusalem, where it says that in verse 3 that all Jerusalem was troubled with him. They were troubled with him. And I would say, hey, all Jerusalem, we'd like to ask you a question. What troubled you so much? What troubled you so much? And then the spokesman would say this. This is just my imagination. Well, Herod is a dangerous person to make angry. When he gets angry, blood is shed. Therefore, we don't want to upset King Herod. And anyway, Herod reestablished sacrifice, and he built us this great temple and these great structures. Let's just not rock the boat, okay? So they were troubled with him. Now, I would want to especially spend time with these magi. I would want to ask them all kinds of questions. These magi were wise men. They studied books. They were men of learning, intelligent. They advised kings. They interpreted signs. Possibly these wise men were from Babylon, where Daniel was a wise man, even the chief of the wise men. And surely, because Daniel was there and his friends, the Torah was there, the writings of the prophets were there, and that they had access to these things. We don't know why. The text doesn't tell us why they believed that this star was his star, but clearly they were right. There's lots of speculation about what they saw, what they knew from the writings. One might be this. Okay, this is in the book of Numbers. Remember that strange man Balaam during the Exodus when God's people were in the wilderness? This is what it says. The oracle of Balaam, the son of Beor, the oracle of the man whose eye is opened, the oracle of him who hears the words of God and knows the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty, falling down with his eyes uncovered. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. It shall crush the forehead of Moab and break down all the sons of Sheth. Maybe he was looking at the servant songs in the book of Isaiah or these magi. Maybe they were looking at these things. We don't really know. It doesn't tell us. But they had some knowledge that there would be a king in Israel. And they had some knowledge that this star was attached to it. So what would we ask these magi for our interview? We would say, hey, magi, I think I'd be open-ended. You know, coming back from Israel, I would want to ask these magi, what was the one highlight of your trip? I know some of you have asked me that. I love you. It's really hard to just say one thing. So let's be more open-ended. Hey, magi, what happened on your road trip to Israel? And they would answer us, well, you know, it started with signs. We're men of learning. We knew that there was a sign that the king of the Jews was being born and was born. We saw his star. So we went to Judea. It was a long journey. Well, of course, we got to Jerusalem and, you know, Herod's palace. It was really nice. The food was outstanding. But King Herod was confused when we got there. And our time with him was, well, it was strange. He was a man who knew the Jewish scriptures, and he had experts that studied it all the time. They advised him. He called these wise men, chief priests and scribes, they're called. And he said, where is the Messiah to be born? And just as quickly they answered, in Bethlehem. And they quoted from one of their prophets, a prophet named Micah. So when we were there, we could see that he knew the Jewish scriptures, but we could also see something else. And eventually we put these pieces together, that he didn't submit to them. I guess you could say he dabbled in theology, but he remained the sole ruler of his life, just like he wanted to be the sole ruler of Israel. You know, looking back, we magi, I guess Herod wasn't as honest with us as we thought. Maybe the beautiful palace and the lavish hospitality, maybe it tricked us a little. We learned later that he secretly got us to tell him when the star first appeared. We didn't know he was so dangerous while we were with him, but thankfully God warned us in a dream. Anyway, all that pomp, that wasn't the highlight of our road trip. The highlight was 5 miles away. In this rundown, hilly little village. It was a humble village called Bethlehem. After these things with King Herod, it was night again and we could see the star. We saw the star again. After this strange encounter with Herod, we saw it again. And it led us to Bethlehem, to the very house where the child was. It was amazing. We were so joyful. You can't imagine the joy we felt that God could bring us to the very house where the child was. God used that star to lead us to the king, to his king. That was the highlight. We found him. We were filled with so much joy. We just threw ourselves down. We opened up our treasures and we gave him the gifts. We worshiped the king there in Bethlehem. The joy was unbelievable. And then we returned to our home. Life-changing. I think that's how the Magi would answer that question about the road trip. Maybe one more question. Joseph. Hey, Joseph. Tell us about how you moved to Egypt and then back to Nazareth. Like, what was that whole time about? What was going on? What can you tell us about it? And I can see Joseph in his carpenter's shop. Well, I guess what I remember most are the dreams. They were vivid. I mean, God spoke to me. He sent the angel of the Lord. But then there were those wealthy guys, foreigners, you know. They showed up one night, and they knocked on the door. We were poor. You know, we just had a simple house in Bethlehem, built it with my own hands. Anyway, next thing I know, these wealthy guys from another country are bowing down to the baby. We had experienced some things, and God had told us this is different. And well, we named him because God told us, you know, he is God with us. Somehow these guys knew something about that. They bowed down and they presented these treasures to the baby. It was gold and frankincense and myrrh. I mean, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. That was really handy when we moved to Egypt. and when we had to relocate and ended up back in Nazareth, what would I say about those moves? I guess I would say that God really protected and provided for us. And we really had some close calls there, too. So I guess we could go on with our interviews with other people in this narrative. And I think it'd be fun to ask a few other questions. Maybe we can do that more later. But let's observe a few things about this very familiar story. These are some things that we can reflect on today and tomorrow. I think it's great that Christmas Eve is on a Sunday and we get to start the day. No one has to work a half day today except us. Charles Spurgeon said, "Those who seek Jesus will find him. Those who find him will worship him. And those who worship him will devote all they have to him." And he references Matthew 7. "Seek and you will find, for he who seeks finds." Let's notice also this. I want you to notice the unseen reality at work in this narrative. You know, we live in a time where the mindset of most people is somewhat what we would call secular. And it's in a culture and a time that is increasingly what we've called post-Christian, where the highest reason for most people is what we call science today, observable facts. And then what do we do with these things? Where a high-level neurosurgeon has a dream or some experience with death and then comes back and tells us about Jesus. Or about Muslims in the Middle East who are dreaming about going and reading a book with someone who's a Christian missionary. What do we do with the supernatural? How do we make sense of that? Well, in this narrative, we also see that there is supernatural things, that there are supernatural things at work and at play with what's happening there. God breaks into the normal things of earth with things of a larger reality. In our narrative alone, we have dreams from God, prophecies, angels, and what is called a star. One day, this unseen reality will become clear to everyone. But for now, we have the news. And what is important for us is that there's news of a king. And he was born and he came from this greater reality. He's one who always existed. And he came into our world, as Carol sung. He came to be born in a humble town in Bethlehem. He grew up in Nazareth. This is the big reality. This is what transcends the earthly, what is bigger than the things of this world, than all the pomp and glory of someone like Herod. The reality is that Christ, God the Son, who always was, who is truly God, became truly man. The unseen reality broke into what we can feel and touch and behold. And he lived in our world. And he died. And he came alive again. This heaven-born king, this prince of peace. This unseen reality is what we are to observe in this and think about in our day today. The unseen reality is still there. The heaven-born prince is still the king. And this draws sort of a line. Let's continue with another observation. In our passage, those who worship at this point in the narrative are an extreme minority and are in great danger because of the king and their association with him. The Magi are sent on a bypass. Don't go back through Jerusalem. Don't go back to Herod. Maybe they went up through what became called the Decapolis, or maybe they went through the Arabian desert to get back to their home in the east. But they were at risk. Joseph, Mary, and Jesus are sent to cross the Sinai desert to Egypt. God sent them through the wilderness down into Egypt because they were at risk. Here's an observation. Here's an application for us. You might be the only worshiper of this king, Jesus, where you work or where you live. You might face real opposition because of it. I want you to take heart God's king and God's kingdom cannot be stopped by the strongest opposition in this world. And the things that go beyond the things of this world, even beyond the grave, are what really matter. Some people will do anything to be rid of Jesus' authority. And friends, that comes down to the very heart of what this passage is about. Who's really the king? Who really has authority? Some people will do anything to be rid of that authority, even slaughter innocent children and decimate families. Those who strive for their own glory cannot remain with the king who deserves all honor and glory. He will have no rivals. He's the stone that the builders rejected. But you can't defeat him. He overcomes all opposition. He demands all authority. Look at what happened with Herod. Herod was very powerful. He intended to kill the child. But in our narrative, it is the king Herod, in the end, who is dead. It reminds me of how another king in Israel, King Saul, was jealous of young King David. But remember what happened in that narrative? Every time Saul threw a spear at David, he missed. And Saul looked at David and he said, I need to be done with him. I want to kill this one who would compete for my kingship, my throne. And so he said, I'm going to send him. Why should I kill him? I'll send him to the Philistines. They'll kill him. The Philistines are tough. Ironically, what God did was God used David's fighting with the Philistines to make David stronger. And Saul ended up in the end dying by the hands of the Philistines. Isn't that ironic? Look at what happened with Herod. Herod saw a threat to his kingdom and he wanted to hold on to his glory. And he wouldn't give way to God's plan and to God's king. What happened to Herod? He didn't last much longer. It's that way with all of us. Would you be the king of your life? Would you hold on to glory or the things of this world? It can't last. You know, I'm 41 now, and, you know, I feel these pains and things. I know that's nothing. I had PT for a couple months to help me be able to run still. Okay. By comparison, you have me beat. Okay. Okay. I give up. But look, look how futile it is to hold on to the things of this world. What if my happiness was in, physical strength? What if we hold on to things like Herod did, to our name, our reputation, to wealth? Why? Why would we do that and not submit to this king who is full of all riches and welcomes us into his kingdom in humility? Why would we do that? When Herod dies, it was a good thing. Herod dies, and it is a relief to the people. That is the thing when the wicked who want to be the rulers of their own life die. It says in Proverbs 11:10, when the wicked perish, there are shouts of gladness. See, friends, in the end, all that really matters is how you respond to this king. Herod opposed him. To him, Jesus was a rival and a threat. Herod opposed him. The Magi worshipped him. All Jerusalem was troubled by him and didn't seek him. Even those who knew the scriptures so well. Mary and Joseph and the Magi lived at risk with him. Where do you stand in relation to this king? Where do the people in your lives, the people you work with, people you know in your neighborhood, in your family, where do they stand in relation to this king? You see, that's what Christmas is all about. It's the king from heaven who will sit on David's throne forever and forever and rule God's people. And he will have no rivals. Though there are many ways to keep from kneeling before this king, we can do it by ignoring him. We can do it by opposing him. There is no middle ground. Each one will either kneel before the authority of Jesus or will not. If we bow now, we are welcomed into his kingdom. When he returns, every knee will bow, but that will be the time when there is a separation and a judgment. How will you respond to him who has been born King of the Jews? Even if he interrupts your plans, even if your life takes a different course because of his coming. You see, this King is what Christmas is all about. Let's pray.